This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Usually, elections are about who's going to win. I know that seems obvious, but it is worth noting because we have a really interesting situation unfolding with the preliminary election for Boston mayor. According to two polls over the last few days, it looks like this may actually be a race for second. So let's try to make sense of those polls ahead of Thursday's debate, which Radio Boston and WBUR are co-hosting with WCVB, the Boston Globe, and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Here to help us do that, Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. Steve is a friend of the show, and Mass Inc. Polling conducted one of the polls with Policy for Progress, New Democracy Coalition, Housing Forward Massachusetts, and Education Reform Now Advocacy. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
So lots of new information in the last few days, Steve. Your polling data came out Friday, then the Globe Suffolk University poll released today. Both have City Councilmember Michelle Wu polling at around 30%. They also have this cluster of Acting Mayor Kim Janey and Councilmembers Anissa Sibey-George, Andrea Campbell, really tight together for second. So first question, does it mean that Wu has her place in this preliminary election solidly in hand?
Well, I think nothing's solid until everything's over. You know, that's one thing. I mean, just a fact about municipal elections is that they can change much more quickly than, say, a partisan election. You know, there's no Republican, there's no Democrat on the ballot. There's no kind of mental shortcut people can take to where there's only one candidate that's anywhere near my, as a voter, my ideological space. So I'm definitely going to choose this one. You know, in municipal elections, there might be three or four candidates that you're still choosing between. So, you know, certainly you would like to be Michelle Wu and you'd like to be Michelle Wu's campaign, given the numbers that are the way they are. But I certainly wouldn't say, you know, there's no way that anything else could happen.
All right, let's look at these two clusters now. So Globe Suffolk has Janey, Sibey-George, and Campbell at 20%, 19%, and 18%. Your poll last week had them at 15, 13, and 11, respectively. The polls have margins of error in the 4 to 5% range. Does that essentially mean they are in a dead heat?
I think yes. And I think for a couple interesting reasons. One is that our poll tried to look at a few different turnout scenarios, and who is in second really depends a lot on turnout or will be really affected by turnout. So we basically started with a very wide net and then narrowed it down to, okay, well, what if it was just really strong voters with a really strong vote history? What if it was only people who have participated in past municipal elections, for instance? And depending on kind of what you do there, it shows a very different picture. So if it's only the most reliable voters, for instance, Anissa Sibey-George does much better than if it's a higher turnout election. If it's a very high turnout election, Kim Janey does very well. So who turns out really does kind of make a big difference. But the commonality that these two polls have and a commonality that they share with one that was released by Emerson at the end of August is, yes, it's Michelle Wu in first and then this cluster in second, really too close to say, you know, who's in the lead in this race for second. There's too many undecideds. Okay. Turnout's too uncertain.
Yeah, so you just, okay, that's what's fascinating to me about this in watching this, is you've got the question of turnout, you know, so people can answer polls, so that's one thing. Going to the polls and voting is something else. And then you have this undecided number, which seems to be shrinking. Today's poll suggests that there are only about 8% of voters polled are undecided. Is it, you know, is it a two-pronged strategy? If you're the ground game for the candidates who are clustered together, are you trying to move undecideds or are you trying to turn out people you already have for you, 50% of both? How does a campaign think about that?
Well, it sort of depends on who you are in this case and which campaign you are. So some interesting things we found in the poll that we did, for instance, is that among voters who say that they've been contacted by one of the campaigns, so where the ground game has reached, Andrea Campbell actually does much better than she does overall. So it seems like her campaign is hitting the voters that she's doing well among the voters that people that the campaigns think are going to turn out. If you're Kim Janey and you would do better if turnout was higher, then a turnout strategy might be more appropriate, for instance. So it really depends on which campaign you're running, kind of which of these strategies might be most beneficial.
And given that the top two winners in the preliminary go forward, does that figure into the strategy? You know, like I know in baseball in a game, seventh game, right, you might just throw all your pitchers in because there may not be another game. What about here?
Well, certainly the campaigns will be doing anything that they can at this point to kind of move on to the next phase. You know, there's some issues that you're seeing a lot of focus on, for instance, housing certainly being one. You know, voters are very focused on housing, they're telling us, you know, kind of the reaction, how each candidate's reacting to high housing costs. Education is one that we're seeing mentioned in the Suffolk poll a lot. And of course, the reaction to COVID-19 and kind of how to deal with that. You know, every issue these days is a COVID issue. So how the candidates are talking about that is also something that they're trying to use to kind of create some separation and some attention for themselves.
So WBUR reporter Simone Rios published a story today, Steve, about how voting by mail could potentially have an impact on the mayoral race, reach groups that have historically had a harder time accessing the electoral system. Do you think it could have an impact on our mayoral race?
That's a really interesting question, because that is certainly the hope of easy access mail voting, universal access to vote by mail like we saw in 2020. The reality, though, that we saw at least in 2020 is that it didn't really have that impact. At least it did not have that impact in 2020. So, you know, like you said, the aspiration is that it would expand the franchise and bring votes to people who didn't have them before. But what happened in 2020 is when you looked at where those votes came from, they were much more likely, those early votes came from, they were much more likely to come from wealthier, whiter, more well-to-do communities, you know, out west of Boston, for instance. You're thinking like Weston and Wellesley and so forth, where, and kind of that cluster, whereas the towns where you would hope to see more votes from, if that strategy were successful in expanding the franchise, they did not participate in early voting at nearly those same numbers. So maybe that'll change. You know, maybe early vote will become more familiar and will eventually have that impact. But what we saw in 2020, at least, is that it did not have the impact that advocates were hoping for or expecting.
All right. That is Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, let's turn now to that look at voter turnout. Some advocates are hoping that this year expanded mail-in voting rules could attract more voters. Here's WBUR's Simone Rios with more.
Lynn is a majority-minority city, but the mayor and most of the city councilors are white. Michael Satterwhite, a school committee member running for mayor, says that's largely because of low turnout in Black and Latino neighborhoods. But Satterwhite, who's Black, believes mail-in votes could bring out more Black and brown voters and help him get elected.
We have a population where multiple people work multiple jobs, so they might not have ample time to get to vote. So the mail-in ballot allows for voting to be accessible to people.
Election officials in Lynn expect 2,000 people to request mail-in ballots ahead of the preliminary election next week. Until recently, people in Massachusetts could only vote by mail if they were out of town or had another good excuse. But after the pandemic hit, state lawmakers decided to temporarily let anyone vote by mail. Those rules are set to expire in December. But some activists are pushing to make the changes permanent. That includes Mass Senior Action Council member Paulette Durrett. She says it's often difficult for seniors to get to the polls.
It's always been a transportation problem for them. Who's going to take me? What if it rains? There's just obstacles for senior citizens when it comes to voting.
Supporters say mail-in voting has already made a difference in Massachusetts. The state saw a record turnout in the last presidential election, and more than 40% of those votes were cast by mail. Still, advocates say fewer people know they can also vote by mail in local elections, like the ones coming up this month. That's especially in smaller cities where the races haven't generated as much news coverage. While almost 40,000 voters have requested ballots in Boston, Taunton has received a little less than 20. Janet Rowe, Lynn's election chief, has been pushing hard to get the word out about the new rules.
We've actually picked up a lot more students that way, that are away at college, now that they know they can just go online, download the application, email it back to us. So people love the mail-in voting.
State Republicans have expressed concern that mail-in voting could make it easier to cast fraudulent ballots. And not all Democrats are enthusiastic about voting by mail. Lynn Mayoral candidate and City Council President Darren Sir wasn't even sure mail-in was an option in the coming election.
I don't know if I support mail-in voting as much as in person. And I'm not saying I don't support it. I don't know. Never really given it any thought, to be honest with you.
But some advocates are betting the mail-in option will spur voting in communities of color. Across Massachusetts, blacks and Latinos voted a far lower rate than white voters. While 71% of whites turned out in 2020, only 51% of Hispanics voted, and just 36% of blacks. That's the lowest black turnout percentage in the country, according to data from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Doug Chavez is a Boston-based political consultant who specializes in mobilizing Latino voters. He says low turnout among blacks and Latinos is about class and education, but also disenchantment with politics.
They're not confident in the leaders coming through for them. They haven't in the past. Black and brown folks have been left behind economically, education, healthcare system. Look what happened during the pandemic. It blew up the disparities that exist in our communities.
But Chavez says mail-in voting could change that. The problem, he says, is not enough people know about the option.
I just wish they would have done a little more advertising or run a better awareness campaign. Some people weren't even aware that mail-in ballot was an option this year.
Last year, state election officials took significant efforts to encourage people to vote by mail in November, sending every voter an application. But the Secretary of State's office says it was too late to send similar mailings this year because lawmakers waited too long to extend the vote-by-mail rules. That means local officials are on their own to get the word out this election season.
WBUR's Simone Rios reporting that story. You can visit WBUR.org to check out our guide on voting in the Boston mayor's race and get a closer look at the candidates in Boston, plus some key races in other cities and towns. And then don't miss that special Radio Boston this Thursday night at 7, WBUR and Radio Boston, in partnership with the Boston Globe, WCVB Channel 5, and the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. We'll bring you a 1-hour virtual debate live from WBUR City Space. All 5 major candidates will be there. You can find more details at wbur.org/events. One of the things that I love about Boston is the incredible wealth of knowledge in and around the city, and our next guest is a perfect example. Randall Kennedy is an author and a professor at Harvard Law School. Kennedy has spent decades studying and writing about prominent black leaders throughout our nation's history and how our society has handled race, past and present. Kennedy's new book is a collection of essays that he has written along the way titled Say It Loud, on race, law, history, and culture. We are looking forward to having a conversation with him about it today. Do we have Professor Kennedy? Professor Kennedy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you on. We're getting a little bit of echo, so in a minute I may have to let you go. Let's see how we do with this. We might have to bring you back, but let's start. The book is called Say It Loud, which is obviously a reference to the James Brown song, and I want to ask you to tell our listeners, what are you saying loud with this book?
I'm saying loud that the race question has been a central question in American life since the beginning of the country. It remains a central question, and it's a complicated question. And we have to be willing to deal with our issues with a certain amount of patience, a certain amount of willingness to deal with tension and complication. Those are some of the things that I'm trying to say in this set of essays.
So the book really leans into two of the words you just used, complexity and tension. You do not shy away from sort of fully looking at what's at play in the major racial questions of the day, of the last couple hundred years. You don't go for easy answers. It would be very satisfying if you did go for easy answers. Did you expect the essays in this book, in this compilation, to kind of run against the grain of our hunger for resolution today?
Well, I don't know. I don't think about it that way. To tell you the truth, I'm seeking self-clarification. A lot of these essays began as discussions with people, sometimes arguments with people. And I'm trying to find my way to, you know, figuring out what I'm thinking. And a lot of these essays, you know, this essay collection covers about 25 years of work. There are pieces in here in which I say, well, you know, 20 years ago, I said this. I apologize for saying that. I was wrong. And now, you know, I've changed my mind. And here's some of the reasons why I've changed my mind. So I don't really think about, you know, trying to be current or trying to, you know, be in the swim or trying to align myself with this or that current. I'm trying to figure out actually what I think. And I'm trying to bring to the page the best of my thinking.
What's the most important thing you've changed your mind about in the last 25 years?
Oh, there are a number, but frankly, if I had to choose one, it would be the idea that people who have been oppressed and are suffering oppression can still be wrong. It's not as if oppression, you know, immunizes you against, you know, human vice. It's a mistake to think that those who've been kicked around, those who've been held down, are because of their experience going to be ennobled. We'd have a better world if that's true. If that were true, it's not true. I'm African American. My people have been, you know, dealt with in a very terrible way throughout the history of this country. That doesn't prevent African Americans, however, from being wrong about things or from doing bad things.
You explore in several essays critiques of African American community, African American leaders by other African Americans, and those critiques often accusing folks of giving ammunition to white supremacy or to opponents. When you lay out the kind of argument you did for me just here, do you open yourself to that critique? And I suspect you were expecting that question.
I wasn't expecting the question, but it's a good question. The fact of the matter is, yes, there are people who say that my writings give ammunition to the enemies of racial justice. I think I've made it very clear in my writings that I think of myself as a champion of racial justice. Racial oppression, like I said at the outset, has been a terrible menace to our democracy. Still, you know, it is the African Americans are people too, and you know, African Americans can be wrong, and I don't feel any hesitancy in stating when I think that people are wrong, even people who are terribly oppressed. So one of the essays in my book, for instance, is about Nat Turner. Now, you know, I asked the question, should we revere Nat Turner? Should we view Nat Turner as a hero? I say no, actually, we ought not. Now, I'm sure that some people are going to be upset with that and against that. No,
he led a bloody rebellion. He led a bloody rebellion, just for listeners who may not know who Nat Turner was.
That's right. He led a bloody rebellion in 1830. And my argument is I'm not a pacifist. It would have been fine for him to have led a bloody rebellion. But I think that some of the tactics that he and his colleagues used were bad, even in the grip of enslavement. Now, one of the things I like about that essay is I point out that there were other Black people at that time who also were critical of Nat Turner. So it's not a question of, you know, the good guys, the bad guys, we choose sides, and that's all there is to it. Life is complicated. There are nuances. There is bad with good people. good people can do bad things. Again, I luxuriate in the messiness of life.
So one of the reasons I'm glad you brought up the Nat Turner example is the essays really do cover an incredible scope of then and now. So you have a Nat Turner all the way to George Floyd. You have a Frederick Douglass all the way to Clarence Thomas. And I want to talk about that one a little because there are two essays on the Supreme Court I want to touch on. One is called Inequality and the Supreme Court. And the other, the first one we can talk about, is called rather sharply, Why Clarence Thomas Ought to Be Ostracized. I thought that was some of your strongest condemnation was for the Associate Justice. Is that fair?
Yes, that's very fair. It's
and
very
why?
Fair. I don't think I criticize anybody in this book more harshly than I criticize Justice Clarence Thomas, and I stand by that criticism. I think that Justice Thomas has been party to a terrible set of rulings that have pushed back the struggle for racial justice. And so, yes, I think that Clarence Thomas ought to be ostracized. And I make the argument for that.
So at one level, that almost seems like a political argument. And there is a sort of a touching on the question of the political history of the court, how much it's been a political body, how much it is a political body. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The Supreme Court of the United States is one of the, you know, great power wielders in our society. Is it political? Of course it's political. The law is a crystallization of our politics. So I reject a sharp distinction between law on the one hand and politics on the other. The Supreme Court of the United States, how do you get on the Supreme Court? You get on the Supreme Court because electoral politicians nominate you and confirm you. It's thoroughly political. And I think it's, the American public is mystified by the suggestion that the Supreme Court is not political. It is. And so when I judge the Supreme Court, I ask the question, do I like their politics? But is it political? Sure it is.
Yeah, I don't mean to be naive, right? I understand that. At the same time, the idea of approaching the court as a political body somehow feels, especially with somebody with your authority, feels like it risks destabilizing us a little bit. We kind of count on the judiciary to be outside as much as possible that swoop of political forces.
That's mystification. We are searching for innocence. We are searching for stability. We're searching for something above politics. Guess what? That's a delusion. It's not there. And I would just simply tell people, get used to it. That's just reality. The Supreme Court of the United States, does it pursue its politics differently than the presidency? Yes. Does it pursue its politics differently than the legislative branch? Yes. It has different traditions. It has different customs. It has a different rhetoric. But is it thoroughly political? Yes. I mean, if it wasn't, why do we have the battles that we have regarding who's going to be on the Supreme Court? If it wasn't political, it wouldn't matter that much. But it is political, and at some level, we all know that.
So I think you know that Justice John Roberts has talked instead about the court being umpires, not making the rules, applying them. That sounds like an argument, a plea almost, for people to see the court as apolitical. Are you aware of his arguments like that, and what's your response to those?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, I'm aware of them. And Justice Breyer, just to go to another, part of the ideological spectrum, just published a book in which he talks about, the perils of politics. Let the court be above politics. I say to both of them, that's ridiculous. The Supreme Court of the United States has always been political. You tell me who's you give me the subject, you give me the issue, and I can suggest to you a probability about how the court is going to come out. Why is that? Why is it that the Supreme Court of the United States today leans in a certain direction with respect to racial issues, gender issues, organized labor issues? Why is it that it has its lean? It has its lean because Republican presidents have been able to appoint a majority conservative Republican Supreme Court.
And you point out in one of your essays that's a matter of pure numbers, that Republican presidents have appointed more court members.
Well, that's true. And that has consequences. And all I'm saying is we should not be surprised. We should not be surprised when, you know, conservative jurists come out with, you know, conservative opinions.
All right. In our remaining time, I want to get at least one question into you about college campuses, since they are so relevant to Greater Boston. You write about them, and you at least partially confront progressive action on campuses. For example, you talk about Princeton. I read you in your essays as saying that the movement to call out racism on campuses has in some cases gone too far or fails to acknowledge the progress also made for Black and Brown scholars on campuses. Is that a fair read?
I think that is a fair read. Yes, it's a fair read. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Keep thinking.
I was going to say that, yes, that's a fair read. Again, is racism a menace in our society, a large menace in our society? Yes, it is, and it needs to be confronted. To confront it effectively, however, it's going to be very important not to exaggerate. It's going to be very important to recognize progress where there has been progress. And it's going to be very important to have discipline and not engage in, for instance, coercion, even if you have the power to be coercive. So even if you have the power to silence your ideological enemies on campus, I say to progressives, and I consider myself a progressive, don't do it. Exercise self-discipline. We want to have open universities. We want to have an open intellectual environment. To do that, we're all going to have to be self-disciplined and respect freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom to read, freedom to listen.
And what response do you get from students and colleagues when you make that argument?
Well, some applaud and some boo.
Fair enough. So, all right, in our remaining time, what's next for you? What are you thinking about or writing about next?
I've been working for a number of years on a book about the Second Reconstruction. I'm 1 year away from finishing a book that'll respond to the following question. How did the protests against racial injustice in the mid-20th century change American law? And in a year's time, I will finish my manuscript and ship that off to my publisher.
Well, when it's done, I hope you'll come back. That's Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy. His new book, A Collection of Essays, is titled Say It Loud, on Race, Law, History, and Culture. It's out today. Professor Kennedy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
By week's end, kids and teachers mostly will be back in classrooms. And while big employers like Liberty Mutual, John Hancock, have delayed return to work until January, a lot of offices are welcoming workers back now, too, at least gradually. And a lot is still up in the air, like how long Delta will have a grip on the country, the status of the Biden administration's plan for boosters. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases talking to Morning Edition this morning.
I think in the beginning, what we had to do, because it was an emergent situation, we did the first prime followed by a boost either 3 or 4 weeks later. A lot of lives were saved by that. But when you want to get to the optimal regimen, I believe the optimal regimen will ultimately be that third shot for the boost.
So the boosters, Delta variant, back to school, back to office. What is still up in the air for you? It is time to ask the doctors. The number 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-2255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. With us today, Dr. Cassandra Pierre returns. Dr. Pierre is acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Pierre.
Great to be here.
And we have a new addition to Ask the Docs this week, Dr. Eileen Costello, the Chief of Ambulatory Pediatrics, also at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Costello, nice to have you join us. Welcome to Ask the Doctors.
My pleasure being here.
All right, so Dr. Pierre, I'm going to start with you. We are seeing, we've got these competing data points, okay? We're seeing an increase in cases in Massachusetts, roughly 17% more cases in the state last week over the week before, according to the state's Department of Public Health. At the same time, the Commonwealth is still ranked 44th among states where coronavirus is spreading the fastest. So most states have it worse than we do right now. Weighing those two kind of data points, how concerned are you about Delta right now in Massachusetts?
Well, it's, I think, too early to let go of the concern. We're in a point where, as you've been mentioning, schools are reopening, some businesses are reopening as well, and many have been incredibly thoughtful about the plans for reopening in terms of distancing and vaccine recommendations and masks. But as we come back from Labor Day weekend, there's always the concern of having an intensifying number of cases that is spread within those work, school, and then social networks. The thing that we have to fall back on is our relatively higher vaccination rates. So our hope is that we will not see an increase as high as we did last fall and winter. However, there is some evidence that there probably will be a continued increase in the number of cases that we see.
So let's pick up on that, Dr. Costello, especially because kids under 12 still can't get vaccinated. School has started for many kids in the state. Boston starts Thursday. Now, to note for our listeners, masking is mandatory for students and staff, regardless of vaccination status, at least to the beginning of October. Should we be concerned with this increase in cases and the intersection with starting school, particularly when it comes to unvaccinated children? And I do want to note, we really did see limited transfer of the virus, spread of the virus, when kids returned to school last year.
Mm-hmm. I think, yes, we do need to be concerned. I think our vaccination rates among kids, even kids who are eligible for vaccine in Boston, the kids 12 and over, are at about 50%. And that's not something to be proud of, because as those kids get, more social, get back in school, there will be more cases. And while we know that children are less likely to have severe illness and death from this illness, there have been 500 deaths nationally of kids under 18. And with more cases, there will be more severe illness and death. And so I am concerned that our vaccination rates are actually, especially in kids, not something to be proud of, and that the most important metric right now is vaccination. It's getting more kids vaccinated so that they aren't spreading this virus to the unvaccinated or to vulnerable younger kids or elders with whom they live.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask a question of Ask the Doctors, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We do have a question on Twitter from Lisa McNulty. Can you get a flu shot and the additional dose of Pfizer or Moderna at the same time? All right, so there's a lot in there, and it gets at several questions that we have for you today. I just want to start in the flu space, Dr. Pierre, because, of course, last year there was this worry about a dual pandemic, right? Competing pandemics with the or illnesses with flu and COVID. Would that compete for medical care, et cetera? Everyone was home. Our flu cases were way down. What are we looking at, thinking about with flu season this year?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there were a lot of concerns that, of course, remained unsubstantiated about this twindemic last year, but turns out our masks and physical distancing and working from home, doing virtual schooling, seem to have squashed that. But now, again, schools are opening, businesses are reopening, people are gathering again in social groups more so than they did last year. And since we have a relative lack of immunity because we didn't have much flu last year, we are concerned that this will be a serious flu season to match what we are seeing right now with cases rising from the Delta variant. So it is important to really think about this. I'm glad the listener is thinking about this already. This is important for adults, children, everyone. The good news is that most professional societies are coming on board to say they are recommending co-administration of the COVID and flu vaccines at this time. So it is something that you can get together. And, you know, one of the things that the listener was also alluding to is the possibility of getting a booster. That's for another discussion. But right now, the recommendation is, yes, you can get the flu vaccine with your COVID vaccine. You can get a flu vaccine with your COVID booster.
Okay, so first, if you're not yet vaccinated, you could now get vaccinated for COVID and the flu vaccine at the same time, right?
That's correct.
Great, great. So now, Dr. Costello, for the second part, and Dr. Pierre just touched on this, I wanted to talk more about the status of boosters. Dr. Anthony Fauci was on Morning Edition on NPR just this morning, talking back and forth with the host about the question of when boosters will be available. I want to point out, and we've been asked to be careful in our language with this, right now people who are immunocompromised qualify for third shots. Those are not really treated as boosters, right, but as necessary to get to a certain baseline level of efficacy. Then there's this September 20th deadline, which would be for boosters, but right now that's not finalized because the data is not in yet to approve even the Pfizer vaccine for a booster, and Moderna and J&J would be further behind. Do I have all of that right?
I think you do. Cassandra, you might be able to weigh on this better than I as an infectious disease specialist, but that is absolutely my understanding as well.
And Dr. Pierre, anything I'm missing there?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, we're still in a state of trying to look at what we can do based on what the science dictates and also where we are with supply. So, yes, I think it is true that right now the third dose or the additional dose for those who are immunocompromised are recommended, but we don't have recommendations as of yet for a booster dose.
So, Dr. Costello, I saw a question on social media today which did it occurred to me it would be a good one to ask you, and it was a person asking, how can we not be approved for children under the age of 12 yet for the vaccine, but we can be administering third doses to people who are already vaccinated? Now, I suspect I have some sense of what the answer to that question is, but it seems like a good one to have you clarify.
It's an excellent one. I think all of us are very eager to get the next group of kids. The clinical trials now are for 5 to 11-year-olds, and it's not a question of supply. It's not that we don't have adequate supply to vaccinate them. It's just that the bar is higher when you're talking about childhood vaccines. Like we need higher numbers than we need for the adults to be sure that we're not causing any harm. And we're just not there yet. So I think when the numbers are adequate to show that this is a safe and effective vaccine for children under 12, then it will be approved. But it's not a supply question.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your question. We've got Nina on the line in Walpole. Nina, go ahead.
Thank you so much. My question relates to booster shots and the risk of having a booster shot too early. For example, I have been vaccinated in June. There's a potential I will be abroad for the year, and I may not have access to have a booster shot there. And I was hoping potentially to have it before I leave, but I wasn't sure, again, if that would be too much of a risk.
Dr. Pierre.
It's a great question. You know, so the immune system is an amazing it's an amazing thing, but it needs time to mature. And so in addition to, unfortunately, not having recommendations or guidance about the booster shots quite yet, we also know that giving an additional dose or a booster shot too soon might not actually do anything at all. We do need to make sure that the booster doses are timed appropriately to give us the maximum amount of boosting that charges our immune system. So my guess is that in June, you know, right now we're in September, it's only been 3 months. Probably you won't see that benefit. You may not see the benefit from boosting by getting that additional dose at this moment.
So, Dr. Costello, We are now at a point where we talked about schools, kids back in. Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of Brown University School of Public Health, says, okay, vaccines, rapid tests, improving indoor air, masks. Those are the top four strategies. But he's also said, get the first three right. Vaccines, rapid tests, improving indoor air. It means we can use the fourth more sparingly. Do you agree? And is there a point this year where if air is up to quality, vaccinations are up to par, kids might be able to be safely mask-free in schools?
That's such an interesting question. And I think if we get our vaccination rates really, really high among everyone who's eligible to be vaccinated, it's possible, but we are nowhere near that. You know, one question you asked earlier is about not seeing a huge uptick in cases in the spring when kids went back to school, but that was before the Delta variant really arrived in Massachusetts. And now it's here, and it's a very transmissible virus. It's much more transmissible than the Alpha variant, on a line with chickenpox, for example. And, you know, an index case can infect up to six other people. And so I think that the idea of taking off masks before people are really highly vaccinated, I think is too dangerous at this point.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus questions. And we have a lot of questions still, too, Dr. Pierre. There's one that's sort of been on my list to ask for a couple of weeks, and I finally get a chance to ask it here. And it is about the folks who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I understand there are just fewer people in the country who have received it, and it came later, which means that there's a data lag there. We hear regularly from listeners saying, wait a minute, I had the J&J shot. Nobody's talking about boosters for us. Nobody's talking about definitive answers on whether efficacy is waning. I don't know if I'm in one of the classes that has a statement of caution issued around it, that, well, I have to get the J&J booster if and when it's time for a booster for J&J. So, one, how to deal with that lag for a percentage of the population who got a vaccine that people said go get? And two, what do we know about catching the Johnson & Johnson vaccine data up with Moderna and Pfizer as we move along?
Yeah, another great question. And I completely share that cause of concern. I mean, we want to make sure that everyone is, you know, when it's time for booster shots, those who are at highest risk, whatever the prioritization of those booster shots are, can get it, hopefully regardless of the vaccine that they received. However, as you mentioned, the J&J were authorized later. We know that, you know, it's going to be a shorter period of time from the time that people were completed their immunizations for J&J, so there's not as much of a lag as the people who initially got Pfizer or even Moderna. There is some data for J&J regarding booster vaccines, or at least regarding when antibodies begin to wane. Right now, the FDA is looking at evidence, looking at the data for the J&J antibody decreases as well as for the booster vaccines. I can't tell you, we don't know when that information will be ready. Also important to note that even for Moderna, there's a lag in the data. The FDA has requested more information when it comes to thinking about a Moderna booster shot. So we may be out of sequence for all of our vaccines, which I know is not in a comfortable place to be. That being said, we do know that the time is a little bit shorter in between the time that those individuals who got the J&J received or completed their vaccine series and the time where they would be eligible at this point, given that they started later. But I agree. I think we do desperately want this information and may have to experience a bit of a lag.
So I'm going to stay with you for a minute, and then I'm going to go back to Dr. Costello just as a follow-up on this. Earlier in our Ask the Doctors a few months ago, it seemed like at the time the dominant conversation was around mixing forms of vaccine, that a booster from an mRNA, if you'd had J&J or vice versa, might be most effective. That does not now seem to be the direction that public health officials at the federal level are going. Any information for us on that?
Another great question I wish I could answer. Yes, it does seem to be that our regulatory and public health authorities are recommending sticking with the vaccine that you originally received. So there have been some data about mixing and the types of immune responses we could see, and I'm hoping that there will be more acceptance or evaluation of studies that have looked at this. But right now that data is a bit more sparse than the data that has been generated by the pharmaceutical companies themselves, in which they have, of course, predominantly looked at their own or redosing or reboosting with their own vaccines. So I hate to keep saying this, but more data is necessary at this point. It is interesting to note that very few places, including San Francisco, have already started to look at giving a booster dose for people, for example, who received J&J with another vaccine. But that is, by and large, not the common practice, and it is not what is being recommended at this point. So hopefully more to come.
All right, I think we have time for one more call. We'll direct it to you, Dr. Costello. We have Rachel in Brookline. Rachel, briefly, go ahead.
Yes, now that schools have been in session for a couple of weeks, is early indication that the masking and the really good things in place are actually helping or staying safe, or is Delta, in the face of Delta, are things even still having outbreak clusters?
What do we know? Do we know enough yet, Dr. Costello, from the return to school in Massachusetts?
I don't think we know enough yet. I mean, Boston schools are going back tomorrow. We have seen, even in the last month or so, a pretty dramatic uptick in positive COVID tests in our primary care clinic. And so we know that this is coming and are expecting it when people are together in large groups, that there will be more of it. So I think the jury's still out, but we're sort of gearing up as if we're going to be seeing a lot more cases in children than we have seen before.
And just to clarify, I think it is Thursday. I think it's September 9th that the Boston Public Schools
go back. You're right. Thank you.
That's all right. All days blend together in COVID, so that's completely fair. So Dr. Pierre, back to you. One last question in our remaining time. We've been asking a lot about what we know now. I am curious, what are you watching? What's the thing you're looking at that may not be on our minds? Just briefly.
Okay, great question. I think that, what I'm really looking for is, actually, I have always been looking for this, is the post-holiday information. We know that coming into this fall holiday season, our numbers were high to begin with, unlike last fall and winter. We do have this benefit, obviously, of having the vaccines to limit, hopefully, what we see in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. But I'm really interested in taking a look at the cases and the hospitalizations just to see, to ensure that we're still having this disarticulation between cases and hospitalizations and deaths. And that would be important as we know that our vaccine, our time from vaccination and our immunity may be waning.
I will look forward to asking you about that next time we have you on. That's Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, alongside Dr. Eileen Costello, the chief of ambulatory pediatrics, also at Boston Medical Center. Doctors, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.